aisle again, and I have to resist the temptation to take off my shirt so the cold water can sizzle off my ribs. I force down my field lunch of soggy fish and beet stew. Joanna gets halfway through her bowl before it comes back up. In the afternoon, we learn to assemble our guns. I manage it, but Joanna can't hold her hand steady enough to fit the parts together. When York's back is turned, I help her out. Even though the rain continues, the afternoon's an improvement because we're on the shooting range. At last, something I'm good at. It takes some adjusting from a bow to a gun, but by the end of the day, I've got the best score in my class. We're just inside the hospital doors when Joanna declares, "This has to stop. Us living in the hospital. Everyone views us as patients." It's not a problem for me. I can move into our family compartment, but Joanna's never been assigned one. When she tries to get discharged from the hospital, they won't agree to let her live alone, even if she comes in for daily talks with the head doctor. I think they may have put two and two together about the morphling, and this only adds to their view that she's unstable. "She won't be alone. I'm going to room with her," I announce. There's some dissent, but Hamish takes our part, and by bedtime, we have a compartment across from Prim and my mother, who agrees to keep an eye on us. After I take a shower, and Joanna sort of wipes herself down with a damp cloth, she makes a cursory inspection of the place. When she opens the drawer that holds my few possessions, she shuts it quickly. "Sorry." I think how there's nothing in Joanna's drawer but her government-issued clothes, that she doesn't have one thing in the world to call her own. "It's okay. You can look at my stuff if you want." Joanna unlatches my locket, studying the pictures of Gail, Prim, and my mother. She opens the silver parachute and pulls out the spile and slips it onto her pinky. Makes me thirsty just looking at it. Then she finds the pearl Peter gave me. "Is this?" "Yeah," I say. "Made it through somehow." I don't want to talk about Peter. One of the best things about training is it keeps me from thinking of him. "Hamish says he's getting better," she says. "Maybe, but he's changed," I say.
"So have you. So have I. And Finnick, and Hamish, and Beatty. Don't get me started on Annie Cresta. The arena messed us all up pretty good, don't you think? Or do you still feel like the girl who volunteered for your sister?" she asks me. "No," I answer. "That's the one thing I think my head doctor might be right about. There's no going back. So we might as well get on with things."
She neatly returns my keepsakes to the drawer and climbs into the bed across from me just as the lights go out.
"You're not afraid I'll kill you tonight?"
"Like I couldn't take you," I answer. Then we laugh. Since both our bodies are so wrecked, it will be a miracle if we can get up the next day. But we do. Each morning, we do. And by the end of the week, my ribs feel almost like new, and Joanna can assemble her rifle without help. Soldier York gives the pair of us an approving nod as we knock off for the day.
"Fine job, soldiers!"
When we move out of hearing, Joanna mutters,
"I think winning the games was easier."
But the look on her face says she's pleased. In fact, we're almost in good spirits when we go to the dining hall where Gail's waiting to eat with me. Receiving a giant serving of beef stew doesn't hurt my mood either.
"First shipments of food arrived this morning," Greasy Say tells me. "That's real beef from District 10, not any of your wild dog."
"Don't remember you turning it down," Gail tosses back.
We join a group that includes Deli, Annie, and Finnick. It's something to see Finnick's transformation since his marriage. His earlier incarnations, the decadent capital heartthrob I met before the Quell, the enigmatic ally in the arena, the broken young man who tried to help me hold it together. These have been replaced by someone who radiates life. Finnick's real charms of self-effacing humor and an easygoing nature are on display for the first time. He never lets go of Annie's hand. Not when they walk, not when they eat. I doubt he ever plans to. She's lost in some daze of happiness. There are still moments when you can tell something slips in her brain and another world blinds her to us. But a few words from Finnick call her back. Deli, who I've known since I was little but never gave much thought to, has grown in my estimation. She knows what Peter said to me that night after the wedding, but she's not a gossip. Hamish says she's the best defender I have when Peter goes off on some kind of tear about me, always taking my side, blaming his negative perceptions on the capital's torture. She has more influence on him than any of the others do, because he really does know her. Anyway, even if she's sugarcoating my good points, I appreciate it. Frankly, I could use a little sugarcoating. I'm starving, and the stew is so delicious, beef, potatoes, turnips, and onions in a thick gravy, that I have to force myself to slow down. All around the dining hall, you can feel the rejuvenating effect that a good meal can bring on. The way it can make people kinder, funnier, more optimistic, and remind them it's not a mistake to go on living. It's better than any medicine. So I try to make it last and join in the conversation, sop up the gravy on my bread, and nibble on it as I listen to Finnick telling some ridiculous story about a sea turtle swimming off with his hat. Laugh before I realize he's standing there, directly across the table behind the empty seat next to Joanna, watching me. I choke momentarily as the gravy bread sticks in my throat. "Peter," says Deli, "it's so nice to see you out and about." Two large guards stand behind him. He holds his tray awkwardly, balanced on his fingertips, as his wrists are shackled with a short chain between them. "What's with the fancy bracelets?" asks Joanna.
"I'm not quite trustworthy yet," says Peter. "I can't even sit here without your permission."
He indicates the guards with his head.
"Sure he can sit here. We're old friends," says Joanna, patting the space beside her.
The guards nod, and Peter takes a seat.
"Peter and I had adjoining cells in the capital. We're very familiar with each other's screams."
Annie, who's on Joanna's other side, does that thing where she covers her ears and exits reality. Finnick shoots Joanna an angry look as his arm encircles Annie.
"What?"
"My head doctor says I'm not supposed to censor my thoughts. It's part of my therapy," replies Joanna.
The life has gone out of our little party. Finnick murmurs things to Annie until she slowly removes her hands. Then there's a long silence while people pretend to eat.
"Annie," says Deli brightly, "did you know it was Peter who decorated your wedding cake? Back home, his family ran the bakery and he did all the icing."
Annie cautiously looks across Joanna.
"Thank you, Peter. It was beautiful."
"My pleasure, Annie," says Peter,
and I hear that old note of gentleness in his voice that I thought was gone forever. Not that it's directed at me, but still.
"If we're going to fit in that walk, we better go," Finnick tells her.
He arranges both of their trays so he can carry them in one hand while holding tightly to her with the other.
"Good seeing you, Peter."
"You be nice to her, Finnick, or I might try and take her away from you."
It could be a joke if the tone wasn't so cold. Everything it conveys is wrong. The open distrust of Finnick, the implication that he has his eye on Annie, that Annie could desert Finnick, that I do not even exist.
"Oh, Peter," says Finnick lightly, "don't make me sorry I restarted your heart."
He leads Annie away after giving me a concerned glance. When they're gone, Deli says in a reproachful voice,
"He did save your life, Peter, more than once."
"For her." He gives me a brief nod. "For the rebellion, not for me. I don't owe him anything."
I shouldn't rise to the bait, but I do. Maybe not, but Mags is dead and you're still here. That should count for something.
Yeah, a lot of things should count for something that don't seem to, Katniss. I've got some memories I can't make sense of, and I don't think the Capitol touched them. A lot of nights on the train, for instance, he says.
Again, the implications, that more happened on the train than did. That what did happen, those nights I only kept my sanity because his arms were around me, no longer matters. Everything a lie. Everything a way of misusing him. Peter makes a little gesture with his spoon, connecting Gale and me.
So, are you two officially a couple now, or are they still dragging out the star-crossed lover thing?
Still dragging, says Joanna. Spasms cause Peter's hands to tighten into fists, then splay out in a bizarre fashion. Is it all he can do to keep them from my neck? I can feel the tension in Gale's muscles next to me, fear an altercation. But Gale simply says,
I wouldn't have believed it if I hadn't seen it myself.
What's that? Asks Peter.
You, Gale answers. You'll have to be a little more specific, says Peter. What about me?
That they've replaced you with the evil mutt version of yourself, says Joanna. Gale finishes his milk.
You done? He asks me. I rise, and we cross to drop off our trays.
At the door, an old man stops me because I'm still clutching the rest of my gravy bread in my hand. Something in my expression, or maybe the fact that I've made no attempt to conceal it, makes him go easy on me. He lets me stuff the bread in my mouth and move on. Gale and I are almost to my compartment when he speaks again.
I didn't expect that.
I told you he hated me, I say.
It's the way he hates you. It's so familiar. I used to feel like that, he admits. When I'd watch you kissing him on the screen. Only I knew I wasn't being entirely fair. He can't see that.
We reach my door. Maybe he just sees me as I really am. I have to get some sleep. Gale catches my arm before I can disappear.
So that's what you're thinking now?
I shrug.
Katniss, as your oldest friend, believe me when I say he's not seeing you as you really are.
He kisses my cheek and goes. I sit on my bed, trying to stuff information from my military tactics books into my head while memories of my nights with Peter on the train distract me. After about 20 minutes, Joanna comes in and throws herself across the foot of my bed.
You missed the best part. Deli lost her temper at Peter over how he treated you. She got very squeaky. It was like someone stabbing a mouse with a fork repeatedly. The whole dining hall was riveted.
What'd Peter do? I ask.
He started arguing with himself, like he was two people. The guards had to take him away. On the good side, no one seemed to notice I finished his stew.
Joanna rubs her hand over her protruding belly. I look at the layer of grime under her fingernails. Wonder if the people in Seven ever bathe. We spend a couple of hours quizzing each other on military terms. I visit my mother and Prim for a while. When I'm back in my compartment, showered, staring into the darkness, I finally ask, Joanna, could you really hear him screaming?
That was part of it, she says. Like the Jabberjays in the arena. Only it was real. And it didn't stop after an hour. Tick-tock.
Tick-tock, I whisper back. Roses, wolf mutts, tributes, frosted dolphins, friends, mockingjays, stylists, me. Everything screams in my dreams tonight. Chapter 18. I throw myself into training with a vengeance. Eat, live, and breathe the workouts, drills, weapons practice, lectures on tactics. A handful of us are moved into an additional class that gives me hope I may be a contender for the actual war. The soldiers simply call it the Block, but the tattoo on my arm lists it as SSC, short for Simulated Street Combat. Deep in 13, they've built an artificial capital city block. The instructor breaks us into squads of 8, and we attempt to carry out missions, gaining a position, destroying a target, searching a home, as if we were really fighting our way through the capital. The thing's rigged so that everything that can go wrong for you does. A false step triggers a landmine. A sniper appears on a rooftop. Your gun jams. A crying child leads you into an ambush. Your squadron leader, who's just a voice on the program, gets hit by a mortar, and you have to figure out what to do without orders. Part of you knows it's fake and that they're not going to kill you. If you set off a landmine, you hear the explosion and have to pretend to fall over dead. But in other ways, it feels pretty real in there, the enemy soldiers dressed in peacekeepers' uniforms, the confusion of a smoke bomb. They even gas us. Joanna and I are the only ones who get our masks on in time. The rest of our squad gets knocked out for 10 minutes. And the supposedly harmless gas I took a few lungfuls of gives me a wicked headache for the rest of the day. Cressida and her crew tape Joanna and me on the firing range. I know Gale and Finnick are being filmed as well. It's part of a new Propos series to show the rebels preparing for the capital invasion. On the whole, things are going pretty well. Then PETA starts showing up for our morning workouts. The manacles are off, but he's still constantly accompanied by a pair of guards. After lunch, I see him across the field, drilling with a group of beginners. I don't know what they're thinking. If a spat with Deli can reduce him to arguing with himself, he's got no business learning how to assemble a gun. When I confront Plutarch, he assures me that it's all for the camera. They've got footage of Annie getting married and Joanna hitting targets, but all of Panem is wondering about PETA. They need to see he's fighting for the rebels, not for Snow. And maybe if they could just get a couple of shots of the two of us, not kissing necessarily, just looking happy to be back together. I walk away from the conversation right then. That's not going to happen. In my rare moments of downtime, I anxiously watch the preparations for the invasions, see equipment and provisions readied, divisions assembled. You can tell when someone's received orders because they're given a very short haircut, the mark of someone going into battle. There is much talk of the opening offensive, which will be to secure the train tunnels that feed up into the capital. Just a few days before the first troops are to move out, York unexpectedly tells Joanna and me she's recommended us for the exam, and we're to report immediately. There are 4 parts. An obstacle course that assesses your physical condition, a written tactics exam, a test of weapons proficiency, and a simulated combat situation in the block. I don't even have time to get nervous for the first 3 and do well, but there's a backlog at the block. Some kind of technical bug they're working out. A group of us exchanges information. This much seems true. You go through alone. There's no predicting what situation you'll be thrown into. One boy says, under his breath, that he's heard it's designed to target each individual's weaknesses. My weaknesses? That's a door I don't even want to open. But I find a quiet spot and try to assess what they might be. The length of the list depresses me. Lack of physical brute force, a bare minimum of training, and somehow my standout status as the Mockingjay doesn't seem to be an advantage in a situation where they're trying to get us to blend into a pack. They could nail me to the wall on any number of things. Joanna's called 3 ahead of me, and I give her a nod of encouragement. I wish I had been at the top of the list, because now I'm really overthinking the whole thing. By the time my name's called, I don't know what my strategy should be. Fortunately, once I'm in the block, a certain amount of training does kick in. It's an ambush situation. Peacekeepers appear almost instantly, and I have to make my way to a rendezvous point to meet up with my scattered squad. I slowly navigate the street, taking out peacekeepers as I go. Two on the rooftop to my left, another in the doorway up ahead. It's challenging, but not as hard as I was expecting. There's a nagging feeling that if it's too simple, I must be missing the point. I'm within a couple of buildings from my goal when things begin to heat up. A half dozen peacekeepers come charging around the corner. They will outgun me, but I notice something. A drum of gasoline lying carelessly in the gutter. This is it, my test. To perceive that blowing up the drum will be the only way to achieve my mission. Just as I step out to do it, my squadron leader, who's been fairly useless up to this point, quietly orders me to hit the ground. Every instinct I have screams for me to ignore the voice, to pull the trigger, to blow the peacekeeper sky high. And suddenly, I realize what the military will think my biggest weakness is. From my first moment in the games, when I ran for the orange backpack, to the firefight in 8, to my impulsive race across the square in 2, I cannot take orders. I smack into the ground so hard and fast, I'll be picking gravel out of my chin for a week. Someone else blows the gas tank. The peacekeepers die. I make my rendezvous point. When I exit the block on the far side, a soldier congratulates me, stamps my hand with squad number 451, and tells me to report to command. Almost giddy with success, I run through the halls, skidding around corners, bounding down the steps because the elevator's too slow. I bang into the room before the oddity of the situation dawns on me. I shouldn't be in command. I should be getting my hair buzzed. The people around the table aren't freshly minted soldiers, but the ones calling the shots. Boggs smiles and shakes his head when he sees me.
Let's see it.
Unsure now, I hold out my stamped hand.
You're with me. It's a special unit of sharpshooters. Join your squad.
He nods over at a group lining the wall. Gale, Finnick, 5 others I don't know. My squad. I'm not only in, I get to work under Boggs, with my friends. I force myself to take calm, soldierly steps to join them, instead of jumping up and down. We must be important, too, because we're in command, and it has nothing to do with a certain mockingjay. Plutarch stands over a wide, flat panel in the center of the table. He's explaining something about the nature of what we will encounter in the capital. I'm thinking this is a terrible presentation, because even on tiptoe, I can't see what's on the panel until he hits a button. A holographic image of a block of the capital projects into the air.
This, for example, is the area surrounding one of the peacekeepers' barracks. Not unimportant, but not the most crucial of targets. And yet, look!
Plutarch enters some sort of code on a keyboard, and lights begin to flash. They're in an assortment of colors and blink at different speeds.
Each light is called a pod. It represents a different obstacle, the nature of which could be anything from a bomb to a band of mutts. Make no mistake, whatever it contains is designed to either trap or kill you. Some have been in place since the dark days, others developed over the years. To be honest, I created a fair number myself. This program, which one of our people absconded with when we left the capital, is our most recent information. They don't know we have it. But even so, it's likely that new pods have been activated in the last few months. This is what you will face.
I'm unaware that my feet are moving to the table until I'm inches from the holograph. My hand reaches in and cups a rapidly blinking green light. Someone joins me, his body tense. Finnick, of course, because only a victor would see what I see so immediately. The arena, laced with pods, controlled by game makers. Finnick's fingers caress a steady red glow over a doorway. Ladies and gentlemen. His voice is quiet, but mine rings through the room. Let the 76th Hunger Games begin. I laugh quickly, before anyone has time to register what lies beneath the words I have just uttered. Before eyebrows are raised, objections are uttered, two and two are put together, and the solution is that I should be kept as far away from the capital as possible, because an angry, independently thinking victor with a layer of psychological scar tissue too thick to penetrate is maybe the last person you want on your squad. I don't even know why you bothered to put Finnick and me through training, Plutarch, I say.
Yeah, we're already the two best-equipped soldiers you have,
Finnick adds cockily.
Do not think the fact escapes me, he says with an impatient wave. Now back in line, soldiers O'Dare and Everdeen, I have a presentation to finish.
We retreat to our places, ignoring the questioning looks thrown our way. I adopt an attitude of extreme concentration as Plutarch continues, nodding my head here and there, shifting my position to get a better view, all the while telling myself to hang on until I can get to the woods and scream, or curse, or cry, or maybe all three at once. If this was a test, Finnick and I both pass it. When Plutarch finishes and the meeting's adjourned, I have a bad moment when I learn there's a special order for me. But it's merely that I skipped the military haircut because they would like the Mockingjay to look as much like the girl in the arena as possible at the anticipated surrender. For the cameras, you know. I shrug to communicate that my hair length's a matter of complete indifference to me. They dismiss me without further comment. Finnick and I gravitate toward each other in the hallway.
What will I tell Annie? He says under his breath.
Nothing, I answer. That's what my mother and sister will be hearing from me. Bad enough that we know we're heading back into a fully equipped arena. No use dropping it on our loved ones.
If she sees that holograph, he begins.
She won't. It's classified information. It must be, I say. Anyway, it's not like an actual games. Any number of people will survive. We're just overreacting because, well, you know why. You still want to go, don't you?
Of course. I want to destroy snow as much as you do, he says.
It won't be like the others, I say firmly, trying to convince myself as well. Then the real beauty of the situation dawns on me. This time, snow will be a player, too. Before we can continue, Haymitch appears. He wasn't at the meeting, isn't thinking of arenas, but something else.
Joanna's back in the hospital.
I assume Joanna was fine, had passed her exam, but simply wasn't assigned to a sharpshooter's unit. She's wicked throwing an axe, but about average with a gun. Is she hurt? What happened?
It was while she was on the block. They try to ferret out a soldier's potential weaknesses, so they flooded the street, says Haymitch.
This doesn't help. Joanna can swim. At least I seem to remember her swimming around some in the Quarter Quell. Not like Finnick, of course, but none of us are like Finnick. So?
That's how they tortured her in the capital. Soaked her and then used electric shocks, says Haymitch. In the block, she had some kind of flashback. Panicked, didn't know where she was. She's back under sedation.
Finnick and I just stand there, as if we've lost the ability to respond. I think of the way Joanna never showers, how she forced herself into the rain like it was acid that day. I had attributed her misery to the morphling withdrawal.
You two should go see her. You're as close to friends as she's got, says Haymitch.
That makes the whole thing worse. I don't really know what's between Joanna and Finnick, but I hardly know her. No family, no friends. Not so much as a token from Seven to set beside her regulation clothes in her anonymous drawer. Nothing.
I better go tell Plutarch. He won't be happy.
Haymitch continues.
He wants as many victors as possible for the cameras to follow in the capital. Thinks it makes for better television.
Are you and Beatty going? I ask. as many young and attractive victors as possible, Haymitch corrects himself. So no, we'll be here.
Finnick goes directly down to see Joanna, but I linger outside a few minutes until Boggs comes out. He's my commander now, so I guess he's the one to ask for any special favors. When I tell him what I want to do, he writes me a pass so that I can go to the woods during reflection, provided I stay within sight of the guards. I run to my compartment, thinking to use the parachute, but it's so full of ugly memories. Instead, I go across the hall and take one of the white cotton bandages I brought from 12, square, sturdy, just the thing. In the woods, I find a pine tree and strip handfuls of fragrant needles from the boughs. After making a neat pile in the middle of the bandage, I gather up the sides, give them a twist, and tie them tightly with a length of vine, making an apple-sized bundle. At the hospital room door, I watch Joanna for a moment, realize that most of her ferocity is in her abrasive attitude. Stripped of that, as she is now, there's only a slight young woman, her wide-set eyes fighting to stay awake against the power of the drugs, terrified of what sleep will bring. I cross to her and hold out the bundle.
"What's that?" she says hoarsely.
Damp edges of her hair form little spikes over her forehead. "I made it for you, something to put in your drawer." I place it in her hands. "Smell it." She lifts the bundle to her nose and takes a tentative sniff.
"Smells like home."
Tears flood her eyes.
"That's what I was hoping. You being from 7 and all," I say. "Remember when we met? You were a tree. Well, briefly."
Suddenly, she has my wrist in an iron grip.
"You have to kill him, Katniss."
"Don't worry." I resist the temptation to wrench my arm free.
"Swear it, on something you care about," she hisses.
I swear it, on my life. But she doesn't let go of my arm.
"On your family's life," she insists.
"On my family's life," I repeat. I guess my concern for my own survival isn't compelling enough. She lets go, and I rub my wrist.
"Why do you think I'm going anyway, brainless?"
That makes her smile a little.
"I just needed to hear it."
She presses the bundle of pine needles to her nose and closes her eyes. The remaining days go by in a whirl. After a brief workout each morning, my squad's on the shooting range full-time in training. I practice mostly with a gun, but they reserve an hour a day for specialty weapons, which means I get to use my Mockingjay bow. Gail, his heavy militarized one. The trident BD designed for Finnick has a lot of special features, but the most remarkable is that he can throw it, press a button on a metal cuff on his wrist, and return it to his hand without chasing it down. Sometimes we shoot at peacekeeper dummies to become familiar with the weaknesses in their protective gear. The chinks in the armor, so to speak. If you hit flesh, you're rewarded with a burst of fake blood. Our dummies are soaked in red. It's reassuring to see just how high the overall level of accuracy is in our group. Along with Finnick and Gale, the squad includes 5 soldiers from 13. Jackson, a middle-aged woman who's Boggs's second in command. Looks kind of sluggish, but can hit things the rest of us can't even see without a scope. Farsighted, she says. There's a pair of sisters in their 20s named League. We call them League 1 and League 2 for clarity, who are so similar in uniform I can't tell them apart until I notice League 1 has weird yellow flecks in her eyes. 2 older guys, Mitchell and Holmes, never say much, but can shoot the dust off your boots at 50 yards. I see other squads that are also quite good, but I don't fully understand our status until the morning Plutarch joins us.
"Squad 451, you have been selected for a special mission," he begins.
I bite the inside of my lip, hoping against hope that it's to assassinate Snow.
"We have numerous sharpshooters, but rather a dearth of camera crews. Therefore, we've handpicked the eight of you to be what we call our Star Squad. You will be the on-screen faces of the invasion.
Disappointment, shock, then anger run through the group. What you're saying is we won't be in actual combat, snaps Gale.
You will be in combat, but perhaps not always on the front line, if one can even isolate a front line in this type of war, says Plutarch.
None of us wants that, Finnick's remark is followed by a general rumble of assent. But I stay silent.
We're going to fight. You're going to be as useful to the war effort as possible, Plutarch says, and it's been decided that you are of most value on television. Just look at the effect Katniss had running around in that Mockingjay suit. Turn the whole rebellion around. Do you notice how she's the only one not complaining? It's because she understands the power of that screen.
Actually, Katniss isn't complaining because she has no intention of staying with the Star Squad, but she recognizes the necessity of getting to the capital before carrying out any plan. Still, to be too compliant may arouse suspicion as well.
But it's not all pretend, is it? I ask. That'd be a waste of talent. Don't worry, Plutarch tells me. You'll have plenty of real targets to hit. But don't get blown up. I've got enough on my plate without having to replace you. Now get to the capital and put on a good show.
The morning we ship out, I say goodbye to my family. I haven't told them how much the capital's defenses mirror the weapons in the arena, but my going off to war is awful enough on its own. My mother holds me tightly for a long time. I feel tears on her cheek, something she suppressed when I was slated for the games.
Don't worry. I'll be perfectly safe. I'm not even a real soldier, just one of Plutarch's televised puppets, I reassure her.
Prim walks me as far as the hospital doors. How do you feel?
Better, knowing you're somewhere snow can't reach you, I say.
Next time we see each other, we'll be free of him, says Prim firmly. Then she throws her arms around my neck. Be careful.
I consider saying a final goodbye to Peeta, decide it would only be bad for both of us. But I do slip the pearl into the pocket of my uniform, a token of the boy with the bread. A hovercraft takes us to, of all places, 12, where a makeshift transportation area has been set up outside the fire zone. No luxury trains this time, but a cargo car packed to the limit with soldiers in their dark gray uniforms, sleeping with their heads on their packs. After a couple of days' travel, we disembark inside one of the mountain tunnels leading to the capital and make the rest of the 6-hour trek on foot, taking care to step only on a glowing green paint line that marks safe passage to the air above. We come out in the rebel encampment, a 10-block stretch outside the train station where Peeta and I made our previous arrivals. It's already crawling with soldiers. Squad 451 is assigned a spot to pitch its tents. This area has been secured for over a week. Rebels pushed out the peacekeepers, losing hundreds of lives in the process. The capital forces fell back and have regrouped farther into the city. Between us lie the booby-trapped streets, empty and inviting. Each one will need to be swept of pods before we can advance. Mitchell asks about hoverplane bombings. We do feel very naked, pitched out in the open, but Boggs says it's not an issue. Most of the capital's air fleet was destroyed in 2 or during the invasion. If they have any craft left, they're holding on to them. Probably so Snow and his inner circle can make a last-minute escape to some presidential bunker somewhere if needed. Our own hoverplanes were grounded after the capital's anti-aircraft missiles decimated the first few waves. This war will be battled out on the streets with, hopefully, only superficial damage to the infrastructure and a minimum of human casualties. The rebels want the capital, just as the capital wanted 13. After 3 days, much of Squad 451 risks deserting out of boredom. Cressida and her team take shots of us firing,
They tell us we're part of the disinformation team. If the rebels only shoot Plutarch's pods, it will take the capital about 2 minutes to realize we have the holograph. So there's a lot of time spent shattering things that don't matter to throw them off the scent. Mostly, we just add to the piles of rainbow glass that's been blown off the exteriors of the candy-colored buildings. I suspect they are intercutting this footage with the destruction of significant capital targets. Once in a while, it seems a real sharpshooter's services are needed. 8 hands go up, but Gail, Finnick, and I are never chosen. "It's your own fault for being so camera-ready," I tell Gail, "if looks could kill." I don't think they quite know what to do with the three of us, particularly me. I have my Mockingjay outfit with me, but I've only been taped in my uniform. Sometimes I use a gun. Sometimes they ask me to shoot with my bow and arrows. It's as if they don't want to entirely lose the Mockingjay, but they want to downgrade my role to foot soldier. Since I don't care, it's amusing rather than upsetting to imagine the arguments going on back in 13. While I outwardly express discontent about our lack of any real participation, I'm busy with my own agenda. Each of us has a paper map of the capital. The city forms an almost perfect square. Lines divide the map into smaller squares, with letters along the top and numbers down the side to form a grid. I consume this, noting every intersection and side street, but it's remedial stuff. The commanders here are working off Plutarch's holograph. Each has a handheld contraption called a holo that produces images like I saw in command. They can zoom into any area of the grid and see what pods await them. The holo's an independent unit, a glorified map, really, since it can neither send nor receive signals, but it's far superior to my paper version. A holo is activated by a specific commander's voice giving his or her name. Once it's working, it responds to the other voices in the squadron, so if, say, Boggs were killed or severely disabled, someone could take over. If anyone in the squad repeats Nightlock 3 times in a row, the holo will explode, blowing everything in a 5-yard radius sky high. This is for security reasons in the event of capture. It's understood that we would all do this without hesitation. So what I need to do is steal Boggs's activated holo and clear out before he notices. I think it would be easier to steal his teeth. On the fourth morning, Soldier League 2 hits a mislabeled pod. It doesn't unleash a swarm of mutation gnats, which the rebels are prepared for, but shoots out a sunburst of metal darts. One finds her brain. She's gone before the medics can reach her. Plutarch promises a speedy replacement. The following evening, the newest member of our squad arrives, with no manacles, no guards, strolling out of the train station with his gun swinging from the strap over his shoulder. There's shock, confusion, resistance, but 451 is stamped on the back of PETA's hand in fresh ink. Boggs relieves him of his weapon and goes to make a call. "It won't matter," PETA tells the rest of us. "The president assigned me herself. She decided the propos needed some heating up." Maybe they do, but if Coyne sent PETA here, she's decided something else as well. That I'm of more use to her dead than alive. Part 3. The Assassin. Chapter 19. I've never really seen Boggs angry before. Not when I've disobeyed his orders or puked on him. Not even when Gail broke his nose. But he's angry when he returns from his phone call with the president. The first thing he does is instruct Soldier Jackson, his second in command, to set up a 2-person round-the-clock guard on PETA. Then he takes me on a walk, weaving through the sprawling tent encampment until our squad is far behind us. "He'll try and kill me anyway," I say, "especially here, where there are so many bad memories to set him off."
I'll keep him contained, Katniss, says Boggs. Why does Coin want me dead now? I ask. She denies she does, he answers. But we know it's true, I say, and you must at least have a theory. Boggs gives me a long, hard look before he answers. Here's as much as I know. The president doesn't like you. She never did. It was PETA she wanted rescued from the arena, but no one else agreed. It made matters worse when you forced her to give the other victors immunity. But even that could be overlooked in view of how well you've performed.
Then what is it? I insist.
Sometime in the near future, this war will be resolved. A new leader will be chosen, says Boggs. I roll my eyes. Boggs, no one thinks I'm going to be the leader.
No, they don't, he agrees. But you'll throw support to someone. Would it be President Coin or someone else?
I don't know. I've never thought about it, I say. If your immediate answer isn't Coin, then you're a threat. You're the face of the rebellion. You may have more influence than any other single person, says Boggs. Outwardly, the most you've ever done is tolerated her.
So she'll kill me to shut me up?
The minute I say the words, I know they're true. She doesn't need you as a rallying point now. As she said, your primary objective, to unite the districts, has succeeded, Boggs reminds me. These current propos could be done without you. There's only one last thing you could do to add fire to the rebellion.
Die, I say quietly.
Yes, give us a martyr to fight for, says Boggs. But that's not going to happen under my watch, Soldier Everdeen. I'm planning for you to have a long life.
Why? This kind of thinking will only bring him trouble. You don't owe me anything.
Because you've earned it, he says. Now get back to your squad.
I know I should feel appreciative of Boggs sticking his neck out for me, but really, I'm just frustrated. I mean, how can I steal his hollow and desert now? Betraying him was complicated enough without this whole new layer of debt. I already owe him for saving my life. Seeing the cause of my current dilemma, calmly pitching his tent back at our site, makes me furious. What time is my watch? I ask Jackson. She squints at me in doubt, or maybe she's just trying to get my face in focus.
I didn't put you in the rotation.
Why not? I ask.
I'm not sure you could really shoot PETA if it came to it, she says.
I speak up so the whole squad can hear me clearly.
I wouldn't be shooting PETA. He's gone. Joanna's right. It'd be just like shooting another of the Capitol's mutts.
It feels good to say something horrible about him, out loud, in public, after all the humiliation I've felt since his return.
Well, that sort of comment isn't recommending you either, says Jackson. Put her in the rotation, I hear Boggs say behind me.
Jackson shakes her head and makes a note.
Midnight to four. You're on with me.
The dinner whistle sounds, and Gale and I line up at the canteen.
Do you want me to kill him? He asks bluntly.
That'll get us both sent back for sure, I say. But even though I'm furious, the brutality of the offer rattles me. I can deal with him.
You mean until you take off? You and your paper map and possibly a hollow if you can get your hands on it?
So Gale has not missed my preparations. I hope they haven't been so obvious to the others. None of them know my mind like he does, though.
You're not planning on leaving me behind, are you? He asks.
Up until this point, I was, but having my hunting partner to watch my back doesn't sound like a bad idea. As your fellow soldier, I have to strongly recommend you stay with your squad, but I can't stop you from coming, can I?
He grins. No. Not unless you want me to alert the rest of the army.
Squad 451 and the television crew collect dinner from the canteen and gather in a tense circle to eat. At first I think that PETA is the cause of the unease, but by the end of the meal I realize more than a few unfriendly looks have been directed my way.
This is a quick turnaround, since I'm pretty sure when PETA appeared, the whole team was concerned about how dangerous he might be, especially to me. But it's not until I get a phone call through to Haymitch that I understand.
"What are you trying to do? Provoke him into an attack?"
he asks me. "Of course not. I just want him to leave me alone," I say.
"Well, he can't, not after what the Capitol put him through," says Haymitch. "Look, Coyne may have sent him there hoping he'd kill you, but PETA doesn't know that. He doesn't understand what's happened to him. So you can't blame him."
"I don't," I say.
"You do. You're punishing him over and over for things that are out of his control. Now, I'm not saying you shouldn't have a fully loaded weapon next to you around the clock, but I think it's time you flipped this little scenario around in your head. If you'd been taken by the Capitol and hijacked and then tried to kill PETA, is this the way he would be treating you?" demands Haymitch.
I fall silent. "It isn't. It isn't how he would be treating me at all. He would be trying to get me back at any cost, not shutting me out, abandoning me, greeting me with hostility at every turn."
"You and me, we made a deal to try and save him, remember?" Haymitch says.
When I don't respond, he disconnects after a curt, "Try and remember." The autumn day turns from brisk to cold. Most of the squad hunkers down in their sleeping bags. Some sleep under the open sky, close to the heater in the center of our camp, while others retreat to their tents. League One has finally broken down over her sister's death, and her muffled sobs reach us through the canvas. I huddle in my tent, thinking over Haymitch's words, realizing with shame that my fixation with assassinating Snow has allowed me to ignore a much more difficult problem: trying to rescue PETA from the shadowy world the hijacking has stranded him in. I don't know how to find him, let alone lead him out. I can't even conceive of a plan. It makes the task of crossing a loaded arena, locating Snow, and putting a bullet through his head look like child's play. At midnight, I crawl out of my tent and position myself on a camp stool near the heater to take my watch with Jackson. Boggs told PETA to sleep out in full view, where the rest of us could keep an eye on him. He isn't sleeping, though. Instead, he sits with his bag pulled up to his chest, clumsily trying to make knots in a short length of rope. I know it well. It's the one Finnick lent me that night in the bunker. Seeing it in his hands, it's like Finnick's echoing what Haymitch just said, that I've cast off PETA. Now might be a good time to begin to remedy that. If I could think of something to say, but I can't, so I don't. I just let the sounds of soldiers' breathing fill the night. After about an hour, PETA speaks up. "These last couple of years must have been exhausting for you, trying to decide whether to kill me or not, back and forth, back and forth." That seems grossly unfair, and my first impulse is to say something cutting. But I revisit my conversation with Haymitch and try to take the first tentative step in PETA's direction. "I never wanted to kill you, except when I thought you were helping the careers kill me. After that, I always thought of you as an ally." "That's a good safe word, empty of any emotional obligation, but non-threatening."
"Ally,"
PETA says the word slowly, tasting it. "Friend, lover, victor, enemy, fiancé, target, mutt, neighbor, hunter, tribute, ally. I'll add it to the list of words I use to try to figure you out." He weaves the rope in and out of his fingers. "The problem is, I can't tell what's real anymore, and what's made up." The cessation of rhythmic breathing suggests that either people have woken or have never really been asleep at all. I suspect the latter. Finnick's voice rises from a bundle in the shadows.
"Then you should ask, PETA. That's what Annie does."
"Ask who?" PETA says. "Who can I trust?"
Well, us for starters, we're your squad, says Jackson.
You're my guards, he points out.
That too, she says, but you saved a lot of lives in 13. It's not the kind of thing we forget.
In the quiet that follows, I try to imagine not being able to tell illusion from reality, not knowing if Prim or my mother loved me, if Snow was my enemy, if the person across the heater saved or sacrificed me. With very little effort, my life rapidly morphs into a nightmare. I suddenly want to tell Peter everything about who he is and who I am and how we ended up here, but I don't know how to start. Worthless. I'm worthless. At a few minutes before 4, Peter turns to me again.
Your favorite color.
It's green?
That's right. Then I think of something to add.
And yours is orange.
Orange? He seems unconvinced. Not bright orange, but soft, like the sunset, I say. At least, that's what you told me once.
Oh.
He closes his eyes briefly, maybe trying to conjure up that sunset, then nods his head.
Thank you.
But more words tumble out.
You're a painter. You're a baker. You like to sleep with the windows open. You never take sugar in your tea, and you always double knot your shoelaces.
Then I dive into my tent before I do something stupid like cry. In the morning, Gail, Finnick, and I go out to shoot some glass off the buildings for the camera crew. When we get back to camp, Peter's sitting in a circle with the soldiers from 13, who are armed but talking openly with him. Jackson has devised a game called Real or Not Real to help Peter. He mentions something he thinks happened, and they tell him if it's true or imagined, usually followed by a brief explanation.
Most of the people from 12 were killed in the fire.
Real. Less than 900 of you made it to 13 alive.
The fire was my fault.
Not real. President Snow destroyed 12 the way he did 13 to send a message to the rebels. This seems like a good idea until I realize that I'll be the only one who can confirm or deny most of what weighs on him. Jackson breaks us up into watches. She matches up Finnick, Gail, and me, each with a soldier from 13. This way, Peter will always have access to someone who knows him more personally. It's not a steady conversation. Peter spends a long time considering even small pieces of information, like where people bought their soap back home. Gail fills him in on a lot of stuff about 12. Finnick is the expert on both of Peter's games, as he was a mentor in the first and a tribute in the second. But since Peter's greatest confusion centers around me, and not everything can be explained simply, our exchanges are painful and loaded, even though we touch on only the most superficial of details. The color of my dress in 7, my preference for cheese buns, the name of our math teacher when we were little. Reconstructing his memory of me is excruciating. Perhaps it isn't even possible after what Snow did to him, but it does feel right to help him try. The next afternoon, we're notified that the whole squad is needed to stage a fairly complicated propo. Peter's been right about one thing. Coyne and Plutarch are unhappy with the quality of footage they're getting from the Star Squad. Very dull, very uninspiring. The obvious response is that they never let us do anything but play act with our guns. However, this is not about defending ourselves. It's about coming up with a usable product. So today, a special block has been set aside for filming. It even has a couple of active pods on it. One unleashes a spray of gunfire. The other nets the invader and traps them for either interrogation or execution, depending on the captor's preference. But it's still an unimportant residential block with nothing of strategic consequence. The television crew means to provide a sense of heightened jeopardy by releasing smoke bombs and adding gunfire sound effects. We suit up in heavy protective gear, even the crew, as if we're heading into the heart of battle. Those of us with specialty weapons are allowed to take them along with our guns. Boggs gives Peeta back his gun, too, although he makes sure to tell him in a loud voice that it's only loaded with blanks. Peeta just shrugs. I'm not much of a shot anyway. He seems preoccupied with watching Pollux, to the point where it's getting a little worrisome, when he finally puzzles it out and begins to speak with agitation.
You're an AVOX, aren't you?